Race-Based Crime Policy at George Mason University. She was named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. We invite you to take part in the Virginia Festival of the Book, with events for readers of all ages and interests taking place in person in Charlottesville, Virginia, as well as online, March 16th through 20th. Go to vabook.org. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. Longwood University in Farmville, Virginia, is not a research institution, but that didn't stop two intrepid professors from workshopping a synthetic biology project and involving their students in the creation.
Right. I remember asking you, so I know you're a chemist, but what exactly do you study? I think you said, oh, I study gunshot residue detection, but you probably can't make bacteria do that. And I said, yeah, we can.
Sure we can.
Let's look it up.
Sarah Porter is an associate professor of analytical chemistry at Longwood. She and Amaret Barber, an associate professor of biology there, brought their two fields together to test out the use of bacteria to detect gunshot residue, and it worked. Amaret, you and Sarah invented a new way to detect gunshot residue for forensic scientists out of bacteria, E. coli, no less. And all of this came from a workshop you and Sarah attended where you were to practice making tools out of synthetic biology. What is synthetic biology?
It's kind of like genetic engineering. And so basically, we take different pieces of DNA, and then you could just kind of, it's like cut and paste. You just basically glue them together the way you want, and then you can make new types of little machines.
So interesting. I can't imagine taking DNA and manipulating it. I mean, I know we do,
right.
But the idea that people had not done this before can do it together is fascinating.
Yeah. So, and as the non-biologist, my take on synthetic biology is like taking an organism and making it do something that you want it to do. So they can take all these little pieces of DNA and insert them into some organism and then make the thing do something. Like whatever you want it to do, whatever you can dream it can do.
And this is widespread and popular now?
It is. It's very widespread. Scientists use it for all kinds of things like making malaria medicine, detecting minefields, landmines out in different war-torn countries.
How can a bacteria detect landmines?
Yeah, I know. It's wild. And so basically, they've made bacteria, and oftentimes they also use plants. So you can genetically engineer plants to do this, where then basically in the presence of the different chemicals in landmines, the plants turn red. And so then you can grow a really spread seed of a really fast-growing plant, and then the plants will grow red and turn red, and you can detect landmines quicker and much safer for the troops. And so this is just one example, but there's lots of them out there.
How is this different from genetic engineering?
There are a lot of times you're just taking one thing and making, you know, using just one piece of DNA. And so when synthetic biology, you're using lots of pieces of DNA, and it incorporates a lot of the principles of engineering involved in it too, and how you design these things. So it's kind of like a more complicated version of genetic engineering, or like the next generation of genetic engineering.
So not long ago, the two of you decided to go to a workshop in Maryland, mm-hmm. where you heard they were going to teach professors how to genetically design these mm-hmm. little tools.
Right. I really wanted to go to teach my undergraduate students this new technique that's really becoming popular. To attend the workshop, though, the requirement was to have a geneticist, which is me, and a chemist. And so I knew Sarah Porter just down the hall from me at Longwood University. And so I shot her an email and said, hey, do you want to go to this conference with me in Maryland? And she said, sure.
And what was the prompt? They said, okay, Pears, here you are. Make what?
So they gave us on the first day, like, come up with an idea where you're gonna use synthetic biology to create something that does something. So we had to think about what the thing was we wanted to make and then what the thing we wanted to do.
How'd you come up with gunshot residue detector?
At the time, I was working on a project analyzing gunshot residue using some alternative methods. And so,
right. I remember asking you, so I know you're a chemist, but what exactly do you study?
Yeah.
And I think you said, oh, I study gunshot residue detection, but you probably can't make bacteria do that. And I said, yeah, we can.
Yeah.
Let's look it up. And so then we found, you know, went through the process and it worked out well.
So, Sarah, did you have background as a forensic scientist?
Actually, before I got my PhD in chemistry, I have a master's degree in forensic science, and I worked for a couple of years for the state.
How do we currently detect gunshot residue?
The current method is a procedure called scanning electron microscopy, and it basically looks at the particles that are left behind on your hands and looks for signatures of certain elements, which is lead, barium, and antimony. And so they use three different substances because you could have one or two of those just from contact with other things, but having all three of them is what they use as indicative of gunshot residue.
And how handy is the current test? Is it like litmus paper?
It's very expensive and very specialized. And so most forensics labs that actually do gunshot residue testing will have one person, and that's what they do. So it's a really specialized, very expensive. So I had gotten into it the summer before thinking, well, maybe we can come up with a less expensive, less specialized way to do this.
How do you get the sample from somebody's hand to detect gunshot residue? Do you have to have the person in their hand in there with you?
Yes, and they have special little sticky tabs. They're these little black circles with carbon-based sticky tape on them, basically. So they're very specialized little kits you have to buy, and you stick the little sticky tab all over the back of your hand and the front of your hand. And then that goes off to the lab and gets analyzed.
So you pretty much need to have the culprit or the alleged culprit.
Oh, yes.
Right after the incident.
Yes, if you want to get it off of somebody's hands or their body. And they can get it off clothing, too, but that's less common. Typically, what they would be looking for is gunshot residue on your hands to indicate that you'd either fired a gun or handled a gun.
So the two of you are sitting here at this workshop, and you say, yep, let's detect gunshot residue. How did you know what piece of bacteria or living organism you would use to try to detect it?
So we first chose E. coli just because that is so commonly used in synthetic biology and genetics. And so since I wanted to put this in my classes, I wanted to teach my students some of the common types of techniques. So we chose E. coli. It's cheap. It's fast growing.
And it's safe.
It's safe. It's really easy to deal with.
Let me just say, I only think of E. coli as something to stay away from. It's fecal material.
I thought the same thing at first.
Right. There are hundreds of different types of E. coli. And so you're right, there are some that are harmful, but that's about 0.1% of E. coli out there. And so most of the time, it's completely harmless. And so it's easy to deal with, and we use it a lot. It might not be the best organism if this ever went to forensics type of techniques, but for the meantime, for teaching purposes, it was a really great organism.
Were you guys proud of what you did? Did you think, we're onto something? This worked.
I was. I mean, I thought the cool thing was that we actually went and did it, because, you know, you do stuff like that at workshops, and it's like, oh, let's come up with an idea so that we can get paid for our workshop, and we did our homework, and... But as we were driving back, we're like, yeah, I think we could actually do this. And as a kind of a collaborative thing where Amaret's students would make the bacteria and do the synthetic biology piece, and then my chemistry students would test the bacteria and do all the analytical testing on it. And we developed the analytical method that we needed.
Can you explain very simply what you mean by taking E. coli and making something with it like this?
What you can do is you can have just DNA in a tube, and you can cut it basically with different, they're called enzymes. They're like little scissors that you can use to cut DNA. And then there's other enzymes that are like glue that you can add, so you can glue your little DNA pieces back together. And so imagine a tube that's probably less than an inch tall. And so my students always look in the tube, and it has, you know, a microliter of liquid. So imagine like a drop out of a droplet of clear liquid in a tube. And they always look at the tube and go, is something happening? I said, you have to trust it. Trust the science. right? We will test it, but trust the science. So it's hard to see. But then once you add it to the E. coli, the neat thing is if it's working, they turn bright red, right? And so you have this plate or this tube of this, you know, kind of muddy yellowish liquid with all the bacteria growing. But then you add in your gunshot residue, and then after 4 hours, the tube turns red. And so it's really neat to see that type of change, that you can actually tell it's working.
So was it proven that, yes, in fact, this is an alternate way, and in some ways a good way, to detect gunshot residue?
I think we're not quite yet at the stage of, is it better? I still think there's some work to be done.
What are the limitations?
Mostly it's the time is the limitation, just in how long it takes the bacteria to respond.
You all published your creation, this invention.
Twice, actually.
Right. And one of the exciting things is that our students were authors on the publication. And so they were really, our students in our classes were very involved. It was really great to see that, you know, the scientific community reviewed this and accepted this as really valuable, interesting new forensic science and synthetic biology, and our students got to help.
Mm-hmm. Both of you have such a wonderful emphasis on teaching your students and seeing their scientific interest just explode. How much did students enjoy making this product?
I know my genetic students really loved making it. In the past, we had done more of the cookie cutter types of experiments. They learned techniques, but we already knew about how the experiment would turn out. So this was something really new and different, where they got to create something. A lot of my students are interested in forensic science. They see the TV shows. It's a possible career for them. And so learning the background of that was exciting. And they got to make something and then see it tested and it worked. And so it was really, really, I think, exciting for them. And I know my genetics biology students really liked seeing the chemistry students then be able to test it. So they saw what they made was important for other students too. So they liked that collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Is this exploding? I mean, is there so much to be done? We've barely scratched the surface.
I think so, absolutely. There's so much to be done. If you can dream it, I think you can build it.
That's so neat. Well, Emeret Barber and Sarah Porter, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Sarah Porter is an associate professor of analytical chemistry at Longwood University. Emeret Barber is an associate professor of biology at Longwood University and has been named an outstanding professor by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. Coming up next, identifying the young adults who become mass shooters. Philip Mongan has done extensive research on the phenomenon of mass school shooters. He's an associate professor of social work at Radford University, and he says we can predict which children might open fire, but it's not that simple.
What I look at and what I've been finding is that kids can have a seemingly normal life, and through a number of years, or at least a number of months, kind of transition from the seemingly normal to a killer. There's very few that you would define as sociopaths. Strangely, a lot of times we think of outcasts, right? A lot of our perception is based on the Columbine, the trench coat wearing, gothic emo kind of kids. But the very first one was a good student who was part of his school's rifle team. He went up into his school and used a rifle and just started shooting people below. Nobody could believe it was this kid. Everybody thought he had friends. He was doing well in school. It was a surprise to the people who knew them, which is very common. It's not just one of those things where other people think, oh, that was the kid, I would have picked him out of a lineup. It's surprising most of the time.
Was it a long time before somebody then picked up weapons to do something like this again?
Yeah, it was quite a few. I think the 80s, it started again. And then, of course, in the 90s, that is really when the phenomenon came to everybody's mind. People started to think, maybe there's this phenomenon, this trend here that's happening, and there's something different.
Wouldn't you say that indeed it was a trend? To some extent, it was copycatting.
The copycat, I don't like to use that word more than it's a cultural script that we like to refer to it as. It became an option for students who felt marginalized, to an outsider, some of these students aren't marginalized. They have friends, they have significant others, but to themselves, they feel marginalized.
Why do you think school shooters have been boys, not girls?
That is a $1 million question. I think, and what the research has looked at so far, at least at a theoretical level, is that there can sometimes be this view of masculinity that is toxic, that the only way to assert yourself as a man is through violence and power. And when I talked about bullying, the type of bullying that they do is really attacking their manhood. When you look at specific cases where bullying did play a role, it always is that type of bullying. And so the shooters will see weapons and see attacks as a way to gain power and manliness.
You know how they say in the case of the Virginia Tech massacre, that shooter was known to his family to have had difficulties from a rather young age. But you say that's less likely to be the case in most cases.
In terms of having like a mental illness or emotional difficulties?
Yeah.
When you look back at the 31 cases of the primary and secondary school shootings, very few of them had a previously diagnosed mental illness. And I know as a society, when something horrific happens like this, we think they have to be crazy, right? That's just the thought, is nobody in their right mind would do this. And then there's a habit of going back after the incident and using the incident as a way to diagnose them. But typically that isn't the case in terms of primary and secondary school. When you start going on to the university level or mass shootings as adult, then mental illness does come into play, more previously diagnosed mental illness. But overall, people who have a diagnosed mental illness are less violent than the population who does not. And so even if there is a diagnosis of something, that doesn't immediately make them more susceptible to violence in that way.
The period over which they go from being relatively well-adjusted young people to envisioning and then executing with violence, can you describe a series of steps that take place over a short or longer period?
Oh, absolutely. I would say every kid comes into the process with a different background. Some have parents who you would say this is a healthy family life. Others come from broken families. Some do have a diagnosed previous mental illness, others do not. But what enters them into the process is they first start contemplating, what would it be like if I did this? They start playing with that idea. And then it kind of transitions to putting more information around themselves that involve that idea. They start reading about past shooters. They start to idealize past shooters. They start to think, how would I get guns? And the more they surround themselves with the information, the more it gives them kind of a cathartic emotional release, because they feel to them it gives them power. And then they start changing their behaviors. They start surrounding themselves with information that only supports this idea of getting back, of revenge. And then they start to go trying to buy weapons and rehearsing the attacks. And that gets them to a place where it's not inevitable, but they're moving downhill quickly to that place.
How do we prevent the person from turning over that period of months or years that you were describing?
I've always liked the idea of having either school social workers or school counselors work with students who may be showing some difficulties. Also, peer mediation works wonders. I mean, not only for this topic, but school culture in general, having peer mediators, those types of things, as well as educating students in the seriousness of threats. There used to be this culture of silence where students wouldn't tattle on one another. And then afterwards, well, yeah, he told everybody that he was going to do this. We just didn't think he was serious. And now students, I think, have taken it to where this is a serious thing. And so that helps. Additionally, just everybody paying attention to certain surroundings. There was potential for a really awful school shooting in Minnesota where a woman noticed this young-looking guy messing around near a storage shed. And it was suspicious, so she said, you know, let me call the police and have them check it out. What they found in there was a large cache of weapons and everything else, and he was planning very soon after that to go to his school and engage in a school shooting. And just her paying attention, seeing something weird and calling attention to it prevented that.
Have you come up with any useful theories that would help all of us identify earlier so that we can turn back the clock before the clock hits it?
That would be the ultimate goal. Prediction with violence is always really tricky, especially with youth, because they don't have a long history behind them necessarily of violence. The danger in that is that there are a lot of students who like dark things, who write dark stories, who play violent video games, who would meet a quote-unquote profile that has been set up and aren't actually violent. They may even be marginalized from school, so to select them and say, well, you fit these categories, could be dangerous to them because you're further marginalizing them. I know in the past I get asked about violent writings, say in a creative English class. That in of itself doesn't give us much information, but if it were to come to somebody's attention and you start piecing other things together, maybe they've been having other problems at school with peer groups, maybe their grades have dropped, maybe they're having some violent writing, some problems at home, then talk to the student and feel where they're at.
You've said that these young shooters often have other shooter heroes' names on their lips that they identify and emulate. Is that always the case, are we finding?
Yes, pretty much always, especially after Columbine. Well, even before that, when you can get to Pearl, Mississippi, Springfield, Oregon, or some of those cases, Paducah, Kentucky, Jonesboro, Arkansas, they all refer back, and it's morbid. But there is a counterculture where students who do feel marginalized sometimes idealize shooters. And you'll notice a change in the media, which I greatly applaud, where many reporters will no longer say the names of the people who are shooters. And that is for a purpose. That's because when you take away their name, you take away something to idealize. Instead of it being a body count, which others try to emulate and one up, it turns into focusing on the victims of the tragedy. But they absolutely idealize. And you can see almost every case when they find their YouTube videos or they find their journals or their Twitter or Facebook, they'll always talk about Columbine or Virginia Tech or Newtown now and why they wanted to one-up them or idealize them. And you can even look in popular culture. Zero Day is a movie that came out, I think, a good while ago. It is literally taken from the basement tapes of Columbine. And so in some ways, even though I don't think the movie idealizes those shooters, you could see how a student could watch that movie and actually feel like, oh my gosh, will they make a movie about me? Who will play me? Even one of the shooters from Columbine talked about, I wonder who would write a book about me. And it is a counterculture that some people idealize and want to become a member of, if you will.
Well, Philip Mongan, thank you for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Well, thank you for having me.
Philip Mongan is an associate professor of social work at Radford University. We invite you to take part in the Virginia Festival of the Book, with events for readers of all ages and interests taking place in person in Charlottesville, Virginia, as well as online, March 16th through 20th. Go to vabook.org. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up, we have American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.